PERC podcast brought to you by the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. As part of our free market environmentalism workshop, this episode features Michael Orlando presenting on financial contracting, energy, and the environment.
What I do in my practice is I tell clients basically try to help them think about how to minimize the costs of political markets and financial markets to do what they do best, which is the technical stuff of understanding physics and the real world and gravity and all of that to work through real markets and maximize value through real markets. This in particular is a problem in mineral, generally in mineral resource extraction, of coming up with a financial assurance mechanism to be sure the environment is protected after these firms get done doing whatever it is they're trying to do. Okay, so there's some like obligatory motivation here. I think the economic and national strategic interests are kind of obvious. You know, I have a few citations in the paper about the value of that these resource developments add to domestic output. On a national strategic basis, you may have heard how China is now at the point of kind of cornering the market in a lot of these rare earth minerals because we've sort of regulated out of existence our ability to develop them very much. They're starting to use that as a lever for bringing industry into their country, but in particular, defense in the U.S. is getting a little bit concerned about supplies of some of these rare earths. So that's the kinds of things that we're talking about possibly being able to develop, particularly in the Mountain West where we have interesting geology. These things also, in general, apply to energy production. Energy production is a little more pervasive and the risk's a little bit more specific and because it's just one type of mineral. But I'm going to talk a little bit more about mining here. At least that was my motivating context. But there are also environmental risks from resource development, so we need to be able to balance, obviously, these, you know, the private sector does the good job of balancing the appropriable costs and benefits, and as we talked about, quite often there are inappropriable costs and benefits associated with these kinds of activities. Now, how we've done that is we have a combination of things. One is prescriptive regulation. I'm not going to go down that path at all. We probably all have opinions about how effective that's been. Sometimes maybe it's unavoidable. This is things like you just can't use a certain chemical when you're mining and trying to leach products out of something. You know, and they'll just be prescriptive and say that's not allowed, or you have to use best available control technology. Those are prescriptive types of regulations. The other approach that we're much more interested in is property rights definitions can presumably solve these problems if we can get the property rights a little bit more effectively defined. And what we're talking about here, the way this has been implemented in regulation is there are reclamation and remediation requirements that come after a development that essentially are giving the public rights to the environmental space in the condition that it was before the mineral developer got there. Okay, but with the issue that I've come across is with transaction costs being non-trivial, complete property rights aren't necessarily sufficient to motivate optimal resource development, and really it boils down to when you think specifically about how the rewards and risks unfold over time, you know, you ex ante, it's really easy for a mineral developer to say, I will, and they may be as genuine as they can possibly be and sincere as possible, I promise to be a good steward here, and no matter what we find, we're going to clean up and make it right. Everyone knows ex post they don't have an incentive to keep that promise. And so what happens is unless we have a mechanism to really make that commitment meaningful, then you're not going to get the public saying, okay, go ahead, because I know, you know, we have the property right to a nice environment and you're going to handle it on the back end. Just to give you an idea, the scale of some of these issues are non-trivial. I was just Googling around quickly last night. The Ely Copper Mine is one of the Superfund sites on what we call the National Priority List. And this was mined in like 1820 to 1920 in Vermont. And this alone will cost the U.S. about $18 million for that kind of cleanup. And that's the kind of scale of stuff that I've have some experience with, the kinds of expenditures we're talking about having to put in up front. How exactly you structure that up front amount depends on a lot on the scale of what that upfront amount will be. But even more generally, the GAO had a report a few years ago where they estimate that the EPA on an annual basis is spending about, you know, I think it was $330 to $680 million a year on these on the total servicing of these sites on the Superfund list, the national priority list. That's up about, if you compare that, this is an estimate of like 2010 to 2014, their annual expenditures. You compare that to over the last decade, it's up 50 to 200%. So these costs for, you know, these costs are kind of growing. We could probably have a different debate on should they be, or are we just getting more sensitive to the kinds of risks that are out there, but with growing incomes and growing awareness of what might be in our backyard, there's increasing demands on the public sector to do something about these sites. So the stakes are pretty significant, these non-internalized consequences. So we do have actually current regulation that requires financial assurance, and these enable some degree of commitment and solve what I'm describing here as, I'm trying to focus on here as this hold-up problem that arises from moral hazard. What I really want to do is talk about a few of the current drivers or trends in the financial assurance world when it comes to mineral development, and then really have more of a discussion about, you know, how can we structure these financial assurance mechanisms more cost-effectively. And that's the point at which I throw myself on the mercy of the room and suggest that I have more questions than answers here. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about regulation and resource development and then give you a very brief overview of two of the most common, historically common types of financial assurance mechanisms we've used. And I'll just point out these two things I'm calling the current trends or challenges, and then talk, this is the thing that we're trying to move towards as an environmental trust concept, and then we'll kind of circle back and talk about the questions that it raises for implementation of that type of solution. So the regulation, you know, as you can imagine, mineral development is pretty extensively regulated. There's, particularly on the operation side, there's a lot of these things you've heard of. Mineral development has to proceed according to the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act, all of these federal regulations. You have, of course, a bunch of labor protection regulations, and then we have more specifically, the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act regulates coal, and the Federal Land Policy Management Act regulates non-coal mineral development. And the Coal Mineral Development Act is basically implemented by the Office of Surface Mining in the Department of Interior, and it was it applies to all coal mining on all lands in the United States, federal or state. The states have the right to create more stringent requirements, but they have to have requirements at least at least as stringent as specified in the SMCR. The Federal Land Policy and Management Act, as I mentioned, applies to non-energy materials. This act directs the BLM to kind of ensure that natural spaces are put back in the condition they were before they were leased to a mineral developer. But this only applies to federal lands around the United States. It doesn't apply to states. States typically have their own regulatory apparatus for dealing with the kinds of risks or with kind of reclamation and remediation requirements. So one thing I find interesting about these rules is even though they specified in the 70s reclamation and remediation, in the case of coal, it wasn't until 83 that you had to put up any credible upfront money to say you were able to do it. And a lot of people don't realize that the Federal Land Policy and Management Act wasn't amended until about 11 years ago. Up until that point, you pretty much just had to say, this is how we're going to clean it up. But there was no requirement to actually post a credible commitment to that. Okay, so these, what a lot of people might think of these, you know, regulations not being appropriate because they're really archaic. Part of it might be they're actually very early in their stage of evolution. There's the two most common financial assurance mechanisms historically used have been corporate surety and irrevocable letters of credit. So we're going to talk about a trust after that. But the way that corporate surety works is ideally you'd like the mineral developer in the surety world, the obligor, to promise that they will do something if you let them have this permit to develop. And that's how it should all work. And we know that that is where the moral hazard problem is. So what happens is you have the surety organization, the Treasury lists a bunch of financial organizations that can provide surety, and the mineral developer pays a fee and indemnifies. This is not insurance, by the way. So this is the corporate surety. If the corporate surety ever had to make a payment because of environmental damages, the corporate surety has the right to go back after the mineral developer. This is different than a true insurance contract in that regard. So the corporate surety is not doing an actuarial calculation based on what kind of mess you might leave behind. They're just the big, long-lived financial institution that can step in and promise the public you're going to be made whole, and then we'll take on privately the trouble of going back here and collecting. That's kind of the purpose of surety. And you know, typically the fee and the indemnity are the minimum that the obligor is going to provide the surety. Increasingly, sureties are requiring some kind of collateral, and then they make that financial assurance commitment to the public. The other typical that we've seen in the past was a irrevocable letter of credit. In this case, the regulatory authority or the public has a conditional right to make draws on a line of credit that is backed by some kind of collateral. Presumably, the bank identifies some kind of collateral that the mineral developer has that is marketable that they can secure that line of credit with. And you know, those are two typical ways that we provide financial assurance in mineral development. And what the kinds of expenditures we'd be talking about, just to provide a few more simple pictures, you would have basically what you're doing is you're devising some kind of financial capacity to say in the situation something goes wrong. What we're talking about here is the mineral developer goes out of business, and someone has to come up with some potentially long-lived schedule of expenditures, and this is the thing that you're sort of financing. So you can kind of nominally put all that money under the government's mattress, or you can find some more cost-effective way of pulling that off. Okay? The current challenges, one of the main current challenges has been the increasing concern with very long-lived environmental liabilities, in particular to groundwater and surface water, and to properly address those. You know, conventional site reclamation just amounted to covering it back over with some sod and putting the same kinds of deciduous or carnivorous or conifer trees out there, and that was it. Now we worry a lot more about what are the runoff issues and the implications for water. Okay. In addition, what's been going on lately, naturally for all of these financial companies that step in as the commitment device, with the global economic crisis we've gone through, have very low returns on the type of stuff that they typically would show regulators as being the capital base that shows they're really safe and they're not going to go under if something bad happens. So while regulators are on the environmental side are getting increasingly concerned about very long-term things that these conventional mechanisms never anticipated having to deal with, so they're shy about them, increasingly these same organizations that typically provided that service are under a lot of pressure by bank regulation to show very safe capital. And so the costs of those conventional mechanisms has gone up dramatically. So what's also in the regulation but has never really been used very much is what we call an environmental assurance trust or a trust mechanism. And in this case, you kind of create a trust agreement by negotiating with this party, and you create this third entity, which is the trust. And in that case, what would happen is the mineral developer would capitalize this trust, who has some investment program that goes out into capital markets and basically manages that money for the duration of the life that you're worried about this commitment being satisfied. And in the event something bad happens, the trust actually pays out these expenditures to the reclamation companies, and that's how the commitment is achieved. Okay, so again, you imagine the real opportunity here is if you have that degree of expenditures, and this is where some of sort of design work that I've done comes into play. Depending on the amount of flexibility, this is really honestly a simple portfolio optimization problem, just with a very specific application. Depending on the degree of flexibility you have on how to manage that trust portfolio, you can actually, you know, obviously take on a little more risk and you can reduce the return, so you can reduce the initial capitalization that would be required to satisfy that stream of expenditures, because you would be earning something from your portfolio over time, so you could stay above zero in expectation with slightly riskier assets. Naturally, as you take on those higher returns, you're taking on more risk. So what you also have to do is think about just how much risk are you going to be willing to take that you will not have enough capital on hand to satisfy this contingent commitment for environmental cleanup. Okay? And what I've found, and this is where I think there's an interesting sort of statistical finance paper, is that there seems to be a single point at which, you know, initially the more risk you take on, you bring down initial capitalization more because of higher returns, less than you have to shift up this whole residual portfolio value due to the growing spread of terminal returns in your portfolio. But eventually get to a point where you take on so much risk that you don't really increase returns enough to bring this down anymore, and the initial capitalization is shifting up in order to achieve whatever that pre-specified level of risk is that you want to achieve. Okay? So what are the barriers to getting to do that? Well, we have to look at what's actually permissible for you to invest in. This is a regulated concept, the environmental trust. So ideally, I'd like to just go out there and do portfolio optimization and just have the regulator tell me, I want to be 99% sure there's enough money here in 100 years. I want to be 95% sure. I want to be 80%. I don't care. Just pick a number and tell me how much risk you're willing to take, and I'll give you the minimum cost of achieving it. But what we have in current collateralization requirements, which is, you know, they treat the assets inside of this trust as collateral that the government can take, are that is governed by 31 CFR 202. It's a U.S. Treasury document regulation. And talking to people at Treasury, what winds up on that list really depends on what three criteria. Is how easy is it to take that asset from inside the, what I'm calling severability, how easy is it to take that asset from inside the portfolio and carve it out and move it from ownership of the trust to ownership of the government? How easy is it to reassign, or I should say first, how easy is it to carve out from other assets in the trust? How easy is it to reassign from the trust to the government? And then how liquid is it? Once the government has it, can they really turn the thing over? Okay, those are the three criteria, and if you take those and look at the list that they've decided satisfies those three criteria, it really kind of limits your ability to, well, it avoids any ability to go take advantage of pooled investing. So you actually have to, in order to achieve that severability, the Treasury guidance says, we really don't want you having an account with investments in those kinds of things. We want you to own them individually. So you can't go to an investment bank and just have an account and say, put us in these six index funds that own that stuff. You actually have to go out and have that security in your account, in your portfolio. And then obviously it leads to, you know, it really limits the degree you can gain from diversification. Okay, I have the list on here that I won't turn to. I want to finish up really quick with two more slides, but basically it's a bunch of the kind of investments you would think of. They're sort of government debt types of investments. They're the plain vanilla U.S. obligations like T-bills and notes and things like that, but then there's a bunch of other government guaranteed debt in there that you have to hold. Okay? So, again, these are the current challenges, which unfortunately, even though we have a lot more, in principle, a lot more flexibility with an environmental trust approach, given the current Treasury guidelines, there's not very far we can go to possibly, you know, number one, well, to achieving higher returns by really leveraging what we know about financial markets and thereby have the trust concept used for financial assurance, which is much more appropriate for these very long-lived environmental liabilities. So this is the last slide that I wanted to more pose some questions rather than answers. You know, and the way I'm thinking about this is what we'd like to do is get to the point that we can have some degree of pooling and some degree of, some ability to access a broader range of securities and a broader type of portfolio optimization, which would give us the higher returns. But if we know that the regulatory objectives are to achieve these kinds of things, severability of those assets, transferability to the government, and liquidity, then what would that regulation or what would those regulatory modifications look like that would allow you to achieve that and have more flexible investment guidelines within a trust design? For example, it probably sounds pretty foreign to the environmental regulators, but if you look at bank capitalization standards, for instance, as specified in Basel III, there's a really plain vanilla, like type one approach. We just call stuff like this good capital and we'll count it big in your capital base, and stuff like this is bad and we'll count it bad. And then that's pretty much the state that we're in 31 CFR 202. But what Basel III also allows is you can have different degrees of much more sophisticated capitalization calculations. You can create your own model for determining probabilistically how likely are you to blow it down the road and have too many draws on your capital base, and you can use that as a justification for what your capital base is. That's really what we could be talking about, is going to something like that or a very simple version. But, you know, the other issue is, if you're really worried about the control over that asset, would it make sense possibly to set up these assets inside government control so they don't have the concern that we can't get it from you if we let you have more flexibility and pool investments and things like that? Or does that create more problems than it's worth? So I'm kind of curious about, I hope some of that wasn't too specific and relevant to the conversation here, and I'm kind of curious about your thoughts on how to sort of square this circle of the, you know, of dealing with the public's somewhat legitimate concerns. These are big liabilities that the public is taking on. So how do you create a financial assurance structure that has this, you know, long, provides this long life commitment, but do it in a flexible enough way to not make that be the deal breaker for some of these mineral development activities?
To learn more about free market environmentalism, visit www.perc.org.